Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Welcome to Steve Dale's Other World. And I will tell you the story. There I was at WGN-TV. You know I work at WGN Radio, so I'm here all the time at the radio station. But I occasionally am on television as well. So there I was at WGN Television. And I'm walking down the hall going one way, and I see Ed Asner. You heard me right. Ed Asner, the actor, walking the other way. And with Ed is this nice guy, and we're chit-chatting, and all of us are chit-chatting, and Ed Asner, huge animal lover, I find out. We're chit-chatting. I know Betty White, so we're talking a bit about that. We sit down in the cafeteria at WGN-TV, and I'm finally introduced to Stu Stashtak. Did I say the name right, by the way, Stu?
No, but go
say,
on.
Say it for me.
Showstack.
That's what I said. So I obviously don't know how to pronounce the name, but I knew the name, and I kind of knew the face. So I wasn't sure how, and I wasn't sure if I was right. And that's sort of thing that's happened to all of us, and you're afraid to say something because what if you're wrong? What if it's not the person you think it is? Well, I said something, and it is the person I thought it was. This is Lucille Ball's videographer, and I remembered that because Lucy had mentioned something to me, because I knew Lucille Ball, about a videographer, and I remembered, though pronounced it wrong, I remembered the name, and also maybe, Stu, you were in a book or two books, because I've read the books about Lucy, but I don't know how, but I put it, and this is a guy who never remembers anything, but I put it together, and there you are, and here we are now, so welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Steve. Yes, I've been quoted and misquoted in many books about Lucille Ball over the years. And just to clarify, I was more of her film archivist than I was her videographer. Yes, I videotaped things in her day that she wanted taped. I would, you know, tape things off the air for her, and when she needed me for family gatherings to record things, I would videotape. But I was mostly in charge of her film vault. And whenever Entertainment Tonight or one of those type of shows needed a clip from her career, it was my job to go down there and pull the film and bring it back to my office and transfer it to some form of video so it could be broadcast. And that's what I did for her the last 10 years of her life.
You know, maybe that's how then, because maybe I needed a clip for something. I honestly don't remember, but I certainly said, aha, that's the guy. So to me, you are the celebrity in the room, not Ed Asner anymore. So,
yeah, he was getting a little ticked at how many people at WGN were coming up to me first and saying, we enjoy your weekly show on the internet, and we're thank you for preserving classic television, et cetera, et cetera. At one point, he turned to me and said, hey, who's supposed to be the celebrity here? I was, Steve, I was just as surprised as he was because, as you know, we my wife and I, were just escorting him to the Chicago area that weekend so that he could appear at a theater in Woodridge and then appear at an autograph show that weekend. And, yeah, my show has been on for 10 and a half years, and, yes, I have a lot of listeners in the Illinois area. But, again, I didn't expect to – let's put it this way. Everywhere I went, I was recognized too. And now, you know, I kind of had a small dose of what Ed goes through wherever he goes. But it was very gratifying because I will say this again, as I said on my show the week after I got back, Illinois, especially in the area where you are in Chicago, are probably the nicest people that I've ever encountered in my trips and travails around the United States. I've never, ever been welcomed by a more friendly bunch, and not just at WGN, everywhere I went. The people were just really warm and open and friendly. I think if I had grown up and lived there most of my life, I would have been married a lot sooner than I was in my real life. So.
I don't even want to know what that means, and I do want to talk about what you do on the radio. But first, let's get back to Lucy. How was it that you and she? I mean, you're a pretty young guy still. She's been gone. She's been gone for a while now, since
28 years.
Yeah.
April 26th, it was 28 years. That's
right.
What's hard to believe.
Yeah. So How did you then, a very young guy, hook up with this entertainment icon?
Well, I'm not that young now, but I was back then. In 1979, I was finishing up my last year in college. I did the dumb guy method. I went for 6 years instead of four. And the reason I did that was because I started working in the television industry when I was 17. And so a lot of my colleging was done at night. And I just sort of spread it out over the 6 years so that I could work during the day. But it was my last semester at Cal State Northridge here in the Valley, which is a suburb of L.A. And I was short about six units. And so there was one science class that I unfortunately had to take because I'm terrible at science. Science and math are things I do not excel in. But there was three other units that I needed as an elective. And it just so happened that this semester, fall of 79, Lucille Ball was asked to teach a course in television aesthetics at the college. And I had already taken that class my first year there. But believe it or not, they were worried that they would not fill this class. They put it in the largest auditorium on campus, which held about 200 people. It wasn't that big of a school at that time. A lot has changed since then. And they were afraid they wouldn't fill the class, so they opened it up to non-majors for some weird reason, non-television and film production majors. And so we had art majors in there. We had psych majors. We had English majors. The bulk of the class, though, were television majors. And the class turned out to be just Q&A. Each week,
yeah.
3 hours of Q&A. It would open with an episode or two of one of her series. She'd talk about it, and then it was just Q&A. So it was an easy A as long as you participated. The only way the professors at the school could grade the class was on your participation. So if you just sat there and didn't do anything, you would at least get a C for just showing up. But if you wanted to, you know, get something that would affect your grade point average, you had to participate. Well, growing up, I was, you know, one of the biggest Lucy fans in the world. And I knew the shows backwards and forwards. And so I had no problem participating in that class each week. And she got to know me pretty quickly, and I got to know her. And at the same time, I was taking a directing course in television. And rather than show up there every day and learn how to direct, I had to defer because of my job in the television industry during the day, and they did make an exception because of that. And I got to, on my own time, produce a documentary of my choice to fulfill the requirements for the directing class. And, of course, being the Lucy fan I was, I decided to do a documentary on the history of I Love Lucy, and I knew it quite well then. This was right around the time that Bart Andrews' book came out. That was
sure.
The first book. That was the first book written on her series, and there were a lot of factual errors in there. And just myself, just being somebody, a voracious researcher, going to the library and also talking to people in the industry that worked with her, because I was working on the Norman Lear comedies at that time, and a lot of the crew people, a lot of the writers like Bob Schiller and Bob Weisskopf, you know, worked on I Love Lucy and,
yeah.
and on her various shows. And in talking to them, I learned the truth about a lot of things that Bart had wrong in the first volume. He corrected everything in the second volume. Anyway, I was, believe it or not, I was reluctant to take this class because, as I said, I talked to a lot of people that I worked with at the studio that knew her and worked with her, and one in particular, a director named Herbert Kenwith, who had directed her on stage in the 40s and had signed to direct, I think, five or six Here's Lucy episodes with her in the early 70s, painted this horrible picture of her to me, you know? She's demanding, and she's loud, and she's brash, and she grabs people and says, no, stand here, not there, and just, she, you know, and he was one of these directors that had to have everything his way. And so it was like oil and water with these two, yet they respected each other, but, you know, once he filmed his five episodes, he was not asked back. So I was asking, I said, I have a chance to take this class with her, and she's my all-time idol, and I really want to take this class. And he said, don't, because it'll burst your bubble, and you'll see a side of her that you're not going to like, and I would not do it. You know, if you want to remember her as she was in those days, don't take the class. Well, in typical style of defying adults at that time, I ignored him, and that was the best thing I could ever have done, because she turned out to be a wonderful person. Yes, she was tough, and yes, she knew her stuff, And yes, you did what she said, but you break all that down. And behind all of that toughness was a sweet, sensitive, caring, warm person who never forgot my birthday. I got presents every year and always got presents at Christmas time and was always available to chat. And as a result of that, publicist, her right-hand man, Howard McClay, died about 2 years after I took that class with her. Gary Morton had come to that class 1 week to lecture about how to put a show together from behind the scenes, and I dug every moment of that. And Lucy had mentioned me to Gary when he came to the class, and here's one of my brighter students. You know? and at the break, I went up to Gary and told him that I was working on this documentary about I Love Lucy on the side for another class, and he said, well, give us a rough cut of it. Let's see what you've done so far. And I did. And two nights later, I'm at class, and I told a few of my friends, I just gave a copy of my rough cut of my documentary to Gary Morton and Lucille Ball, and they kind of laughed and said, ha, 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 good luck hearing back from them and everything. Two nights later, while I'm at class, I get a message on my answering machine in my apartment, and it was something to the effect of, Stu, this is Gary Morton. We've looked at your documentary, and I'd like you to call me tomorrow morning. And he gave the number.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, because I had told a couple of my friends that it was one of them playing a joke on me, you know, imitating him. But I called the number he left, and it rang, and they answered, and they said, Gary Morton's office. And and that turned out to be Wanda Clark, who was Lucy's secretary since 1963.
Yep.
And he got on the phone, and he was just going on and on about how great this documentary was and how great it was edited. And to be honest with you, in those days, all I had were two Betamaxes. And so this thing was razor cut together, one Betamax to the other, so the edits weren't clean, and sometimes the audio wasn't clear. But he looked beyond that and basically said, you really know what you're doing, and if we go back into production once Lucy's class is over with, I'm going to try to give you some work. And that's what every college student wants to hear from somebody in the industry they want to get into. So, and he kept his word. When Howard McClay, their publicist, died in 1981, and I kept in touch with them during those 2 years, too. I would, when Lucy did Merv Griffin or The Tonight Show, I went to the studio and made sure they knew I was there and everything. But when he died in 1981, he was in charge of their film library, and he was in charge of organizing everything about her history. And Gary just said, you know, you've got his job now. He said, we don't need it full time anymore because we're not doing a weekly series. But anytime we need anything that has to do with her history, you're our liaison. And that's how it started. And the first thing I did was go in there and reorganize everything so we knew where everything was and what everything was. And it turned out it's not that big of a deal now because CBS has released them all on Blu-ray. But at that time, in 1981, I found all the original broadcasts of I Love Lucy with all the cigarette commercials in them. As they originally aired, I found the 75-minute version of Cruise to Havana, which nobody had seen since 1957, the one and only time it ran in its entirety. I found the Christmas show that nobody had ever seen. You know, these are all things that were on the Museum of Television's list of things to find and to re-preserve, and there they were, right under everybody's noses. And so, you know, I'm not going to claim full responsibility for getting this stuff back into the public eye, but I at least let Lucy and Gary know they were there. And when the Paley Center, which was still called the Museum of TV and Radio back then, honored her in 1984, I worked closely with them to give them elements from Lucy's film vault to, you know, preserve for the public to go and see. So it was a really, really great break for me. Timing was everything, and the fact that I, despite what Herb Kenwith told me, took that class, became friends with her and Gary, and then eventually went to work on Life with Lucy, her last sitcom, in 1986, which was a mistake, but it was still great, great experience to watch her work. The camaraderie that she and Gail Gordon had, despite how bad the scripts were and how bad the execution of the show was pretty remarkable. And I got to be friends with Gail Gordon, too, and that was that's a whole nother show we could do.
Yeah, so tell me about Life with Lucy. That, so let's back up a little bit for people who, everyone knows I Love Lucy. Then after that was the Lucy Desi Comedy Hour, and then they divorced, and Lucy went out on her own, and with Vivian Vance at first, to do the Lucy Show. after 6 years of the Lucy show, it was Here's Lucy. And then she did TV specials, but she was pretty much, you know, except for the movie Mame in 1974. After that, she was pretty much kind of semi-retired, would do Bob Hope specials and that kind of thing.
Right.
And then along, she kept saying, I remember she told me she could never do it again. It could never be the same again. And she'd get teary-eyed, you know, talking about Vivian Vance in particular.
Well, because everybody was gone.
Yeah.
And she really should have kept her word. But there's a little green thing that's in circulation called money. And it wasn't her decision to come back to television at first. Mr. Bill Cosby in 1984 became the biggest sensation on television when NBC picked up a new show called The Cosby Show.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned television around for them because they were been muddling in the ratings for years, made Thursday night's appointment TV. Meanwhile, ABC was wallowing in the ratings during the 80s. And they were looking for something that they could call their Cosby Show. Now, they had a deal with Aaron Spelling that was about to expire, and believe it or not, he had a sitcom commitment with them.
And
I don't know how that came about because, as you know, I've always referred to Aaron Spelling as the Chuck Barris of nighttime television.
Well, we do need
most of his stuff. Most of his stuff was crap. Charlie's Angels. You're not going to tell me that that's going to win writing awards.
All right. So we need to briefly explain because people may not know who Aaron Spelling was.
Well, Aaron Spelling was one of the most prolific television producers in television. And in the 1980s, his big thing was Dynasty. But he also produced Charlie's Angels, and he was part of the Mod Squad. He wasn't the only person behind it. And back in the early 60s, he did produce some pretty good shows, the Gene Barry show, Burke's Law. And he was in with 4-Star Television in those days. And Aaron Spelling actually started out as an actor. There's an episode of I Love Lucy
yep.
where they go to Tennessee to visit Ernie Ford, and the opening scene is in a gas station, and there's this skinny little hick of a guy running the gas station. That's Aaron Spelling.
Yeah, yeah. So he had the Midas touch back then. So you're saying that
he was ABC's Cosby as far as producing is concerned. Let me put it this way. He was to ABC in the 70s and 80s what Norman Lear was to CBS in the early 70s, okay? That's the clout he had. And for some strange reason, they also gave him a sitcom commitment where he was mainly known for these, you know, these jiggly-wiggly, hour-long drama shows and these syrupy soap opera, that Dynasty, okay? That's the type of shows he did. So anyway, he had this sitcom commitment. This is like late in 1985, mm-hmm. and Lucy and Gary are having dinner at Spago one night, and Aaron Spelling walks by them and says hello, you know, and walks past them and then walks back to them. Now, this is the way Gary Morton told the story, and says to Lucy and Gary, you know, I have a sitcom commitment for ABC that's going to expire, and if I don't exercise the option, I'm going to lose a ton of money on this because it wasn't a pay-or-play deal. Have you guys got any idea on what I could do? And, you know, Lucy had been out of weekly television at that point for, you know, 11 years. And they both said no. And then he said, is there any chance at all I could talk you guys into coming back into television? And they immediately said no, and that was the end of that. Well, Gary started thinking about this, and 2 days later, he called him up and said, you know, I've been thinking about this, and NBC's got Cosby. Find out what he gets a week, and if you can give us $100,000 more a week per episode than what Cosby is getting, we'll consider it. Okay, and then you know what happened.
Yeah.
There were other considerations. ABC had to pick up the show without a pilot and without a concept. Just give us a 13-week commitment. Actually, no, I take that back. A 22-week commitment, and we'll deliver 22 half hours to you for X amount of dollars. It was a lot of money. It was an enormous amount of money for the two of them. And they worked it out. And so Lucy, being Lucy, wanted Bob and Madeline, Bob Carroll and Madeline Davis, back because they did all the magic for I Love Lucy. She failed, and then, don't get me wrong here. I love Bob and Madeline. They're wonderful, nice, terrific people, but they could only write one thing. Do you remember they were executive producers on Alice?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Do you remember that Alice every week was Lucy and Ethel with Flo and Alice?
Yep.
Or at
yep.
least they tried to be.
Yep.
Just like they were also executive producers of The Mothers-in-Law. And Eve Art and Kay Ballard were Lucy and Ethel on that. All right. So they only knew how to write one thing. And Lucy forgot that Bob and Madeline wrote a lot of Here's Lucy episodes that weren't very good. As Lucy got older and was on week after week after week, her character from the zany, wacky housewife sort of evolved into this pushy, loud, obnoxious, you know, widowed woman, all right? It was a gradual change during the Lucy show, the mm-hmm. second series, but by the end of the Lucy show, by the time Vivian had left and by the time she and Mr. Mooney were yelling at each other in the bank and Frankie Avalon would show up and the whole bank would break out in song and dance with a live orchestra. I mean, that's what that evolved to. Now, Bob and Madeline were not working during that era, but they came back when Lucy brought her own kids into the show, and it was still the guest star of the week with everybody breaking into song and dance. All of a sudden, there's a 20-piece orchestra in the park or something, you know. That's when the shows started to get schmaltzy and sticky like a Bob Hope sketch would get. And Bob and Madeline were a part of that. My point being that instead of hiring Bob and Madeline back, if we were going to survive in the 80s, in the era of the Golden Girls, we needed to have young, hip writers that were familiar enough with what she could do by watching her reruns, but still make the shows more sophisticated and not trying to jam the fact that although she was 75, she could still do the slapstick. That was our biggest downfall on that. And again, she got it so Bob and Madeline had to write the show. I'm sure ABC was not thrilled about that because their track record since I Love Lucy, even though they worked a lot, the shows they worked on were not of the Cheers, Frasier, you know, sophisticated quality. You know, you can't knock their success in their careers, but and she wanted them back as a security blanket. That was the first mistake because if you recall in the 80s, I Love Lucy was probably bigger than it was than when it was on in the 50s. You could watch that show 3, 4, 5 times a day on various channels.
Sure.
And they figured that's what everybody wanted. So that's why they tailored the show for her to do slapstick and some of the stuff like she did in the early years of the Lucy show and the years of I Love Lucy. And it just didn't play well when she's 75 and her voice from all the cigarette smoking was 6 octaves lower than it was on I Love Lucy. And then they brought back Gail Gordon, too, because she wanted Gail on the show. And I, nothing against him. He was wonderful, but all we ended up doing was rehashing stuff that had been done before. And, you know, our first episode, they put us on Saturday night because they figured that was their worst night of the week, and they're paying millions of dollars to have Lucille Ball back on, and this was going to be their answer to Cosby, so let's put her on the worst night of the week and try to get Saturday nights back. But Saturday night hadn't been a success for ABC in years. It hadn't been a success for any of the networks because the demographics were changing and the young people were out and they weren't setting their VCRs for anything that night except Saturday Night Live. And the first week we were on, we were 22nd, which when I was there and I saw that, I said, we're in trouble. We're in trouble already because with all the publicity and all the hype, to come back and only be 22nd for the week
yeah.
was bad news. So they bumped up the show we did with John Ritter, which was the fourth show that we did. They bumped that up to second place and ran it the following week, hoping to get a better rating. And we were 22nd the first week, and the second week we were 67th. And it was just downward from then. And I blame the fact that they wrote these shows. They were silly and unrealistic, and they would have worked great in 1951. But they just didn't work on Saturday night to an 80s audience that grew up watching her brilliance in those black and white years.
Yeah,
and
I'm not even sure they would have worked in 1951. So it seemed to me, though, that she was actually depressed. I mean, not upset. I say depressed, really depressed, emotionally depressed after that show was canceled.
Absolutely. Steve, she'd never been canceled before. She had 3 series that all did at least 140 or more episodes of each series. Her specials were not that well received. They did okay in the ratings, but they tanked with the critics because they were too long. That's the problem that some of those Lucy Desi comedy hours have, is they're too long. They're padded. Out of the 13-hour-long shows she did with Desi, about 5 of them are really good, and the rest are kind of mediocre, and a couple are just downright awful. Yes, I mean, she was devastated. She never should have come back. She never should have, because it was a whole different ball game with the media in those days. I said cable was just starting to penetrate HBO and Showtime, and the way people started to watch TV and the restrictions, the FCC restrictions on what you could and couldn't say or couldn't do were being lifted. And here she comes with this unsophisticated, you know, unbelievable show. When John Ritter swallowed the harmonica,
yes.
You know, and then she takes the knitting needles and presses his stomach, and the notes from the harmonica come out.
I remember.
I turned to Gary during the rehearsal, and I said, Gary, this is a Bugs Bunny cartoon. And he basically told me to shut up, that I didn't know what comedy was, that I'd only been in the business 10 years and
really?
To mind my own business. But I knew, as a sophisticated connoisseur of television, that this was, people are going to roll their eyes and say, oh, poor Lucy, how could she do this? You know, but that's the kind of stuff we did. Now, in her defense, she needed this show. She needed it badly because she was miserable at home playing backgammon and moping around. So when she had the chance to go back to work, she would have done it for free. Just to be with Gail again, to be with all of these kids that we had on the show. I'm still lifelong friends with Larry Anderson and Ann Dusenberry, who played her daughter and son-in-law to this day. In fact, Larry's doing my show at the end of May. And to be there and to watch her work. And she was wrong at about with a lot of stuff. If we had more time, I would tell you about some of the things that, you know, but nobody dared correct her because of who she was. We all kind of resigned to the fact that it's her show and she's the boss, and right or wrong, you do what she says. And if you don't, that's where the conflict comes in. But we all knew it. The point is, she loved going to work every day.
Yeah.
She loved, you know, doing the shows, despite it. And she would complain. I drove her back to her bungalow one day after rehearsal, and she said to me, what the hell do they expect of me? Even I can't fix some of this stuff, you know, because they always used to say, Lucy will take this and make it better. And she did. So you can imagine how they were to start with. And so when this was all taken away from her again, it was not taken away from her of her own doing. She was paid for 22 episodes, even though we only did 13. And so they still walked away with the same amount of cash they would have had we completed the season. And it wasn't about the money. She was genuinely upset. And I will tell you the type of person she was. Gary Morton and Aaron Spelling knew before we filmed the 13th episode that we were canceled, but they didn't want to say anything to anybody because they didn't want it to hurt anybody's performance for that night. We still had a contract for 13, even though only 8 shows aired in this country, but all 13 aired in Canada and various other parts around the world where it was sold. So we did have a commitment to finish those 13 shows. So he told her on the way home, after we finished filming that night, and I got a call at 9 in the morning the next day from Bob and Madeline's secretary saying, we got canceled last night. We're having a farewell party in Bob and Madeline's office today. Please come and say goodbye to everybody. And that was a really, really sad gathering. And I walked over to stage one to take one last look at our set, and it was already dismantled. The whole stage was emptied already. They cleared the whole place out overnight. That's how cold the business is.
Yeah.
In any event, I go to this party, quote unquote, to Bob and Madeline's office, and we're waiting for Lucy and Gary to arrive, and we're all thinking Lucy's got to be devastated. Oh my God, how horrible! She's never been canceled. What do we say? What do we do? Well, let's just put on our best face and smile. Blah blah blah. Anyway, Lucy and Gary get there, and she went to every single person in the room making sure that they could find work as soon as possible. And she told everybody, if you need a letter of recommendation, I will write it for you. Here is the office phone number. Call Wanda. Tell her you need this. I will have this to you within 24 hours. She wanted to make sure everybody was going to work again. That's the type of person she was. She was more concerned for everybody else than her own ego had just been tarnished because she was canceled. So I want to get that on record.
No, I'm glad you did. But having said that, she was also, as we both mentioned, personally, and you have the right word there, devastated by all this. I want to talk about your show. Before we do, I have one more question that comes to mind. Have you ever watched Lucy with Lucy. Did you ever sit down and watch I Love Lucy with Lucy?
Yes.
What was that like?
Let's just pick an episode at random here. Let's pick Lucy and Ethel buy the same dress. Okay? You know the episode where they sing Friendship?
Right, I do. So let's describe. Right. You can do this if you want, but briefly describe the episode so people know what we're talking about.
Well, they're both going to be on television on our show. That Ricky's got time on a half hour. Actually, it's Lucy's Woman's Club has a half hour of time that Carolyn Appleby's husband has given them on the television show, and she gets Ricky to appear, and then the girls themselves are going to do a number. So Lucy and Ethel decide to do Cole Porter's Friendship, and they both buy the same dress. And they're both, you know, it's kind of silly because, like Ricky says in the episode, this is kind of cute. Your friends are wearing the same dress. And they kind of dismiss that with, oh, come on, you've got to be kidding. We can't wear the same dress. I don't know why either, but being a guy, maybe it is a girl's thing. I don't know. But anyway, so they both say that they're going to change their dress, and neither of them does. And at the end of the show, when they see themselves for the first time on the air while they're singing the number, they each dismantle the other's dress, okay? And, you know, hilarity ensues, okay? It's a good episode. It's very, there's a lot of great lines in it. Well, I don't know if that was the episode I'm watching. I'm just using this as an example.
Sure.
So we're watching the scene that all of us as fans have seen 400 times. And she says, why did I do the line like that? Boy, was that a terrible reading. And that's how she was. She was very critical of herself. She would sit there, and these are lines that we know in our sleep, backwards and forwards, the delivery, the words, everything. She was very critical of herself, and she would look at Vivian and William Frawley and Desi and just say, God, they were good. Weren't they good? Look at how professional she says, and then there's me. She would put her, you know, and she's beloved to us because of that. So I stopped watching I Love Lucy with her, and I started looking for stuff that she hadn't seen for a while. And Nick at Night one night ran the Ann Southern show that she played Lucy Ricardo on.
Oh, sure.
1959.
I actually know the show, yes.
And nobody, and when I saw that, I recorded it, and one of the Mother's Day or you know, her birthday or some holiday was coming up, and they didn't have cable. They were one of the last people to get cable. That's a whole nother story I got to tell you. But on another show. Anyway, I recorded it for her, and I gave it to her, and she opened it up, and she said, oh, my God, I forgot I did it. She said, you know, Ann did our show a few times, and I said, yeah, I know. She did the hour-long show, the 75-minute show, and she was the Countess on the Lucy show. She said, I'd forgotten I'd done it. Let's watch this. So we put it on, and this is one of the few times she wasn't critical of herself. We were watching the show, and then we're in the middle of one of the scenes, and she said, stop it, stop it. So I shut the VCR off, and she said, when we filmed this scene, Ann had just found out that her daughter was dating Ann's limo driver. and she had a fit, and she said, we broke from this scene, and my dressing room was right next to Ann's, and she said, I'll never forget, I could hear Ann and her daughter screaming at each other in the other room about going out with the limo driver.
Oh my
God! So it was stuff like that. She would remember stuff from behind the scenes on stuff that she hadn't seen a million times like us. And to me, that was far more entertaining than it was to listen to herself put herself down on line readings and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me what you do today.
Well, I did audience warm-ups for sitcoms for a big part of my life from about 1982 until about 2001, and then my hair got gray, and all of a sudden I was unemployable in that position. During that period, I also ran a video business in which I sold public domain television shows on VHS and Beta, and also in the later years of the business on DVD. You know, some of the live shows, the Milton Berle and Bob Hope and Jack Benny, Burns and Allen, the stuff that wasn't on reruns over and over again. This was the stuff that went way back to the early days of TV that, you know, were all done live and kinescoped. And I made a decent living off of that until the internet came on and YouTube and streaming put an end to that. So in 2006, my attitude was, well, if you can't fight them, join them. And I started an over-the-air internet talk show every Wednesday from 4 to 6 p.m. in which I interview and have just conversations with classic TV people. They could be actors or comedians or crew people, directors, producers, writers. And it was audio only up until this year. And I have been doing television simulcasts since January, and now the show is evolving to the point where that's what it's going to be starting at the end of May. I'll be doing my 500th program on May 24th, and coincidentally, it's called Being Lucy's Kids on Television. And on that show will be Keith Thibodeau, who was Little Ricky on I Love Lucy, mm-hmm. and Jimmy Garrett, who was Jerry Carmichael on The Lucy Show, and my friend Larry Anderson, who played her son on Life with Lucy. And we're going to have a roundtable discussion on how they got their jobs, what it was like to work with her, how the camaraderie was, and they're going to sit and compare notes with each other and how Lucy treated them. And so that's my 500th show. That will be televised and audio cast on May 24th. And from that point on, every show after that will be a television show. So basically what I'm trying to do is preserve classic television in a way that TV Land and Nickelodeon, Nick at Night, promised they would do, but never did. My style of conversation is totally different than what the TV Academy is doing with their YouTube videos. They basically compile a bunch of questions and hand them to an intern and have them just read off the paper to whoever their subjects are. But I am very passionate about this stuff, so I ask follow-up questions, and I do tons of research so that I know who I'm talking to. And instead of a straight Q&A, it's more of just a conversation back and forth where I, you know, just ask them stuff that hopefully the mainstream media has never asked them. And that seems to have been what I've been doing, at least from the feedback I get for the last 10 and a half years.
And how can people find you?
StusShow.com, StusShow.com. We have a page on Facebook, but the best way to go is to go to the website. You can listen to the live broadcast there on Wednesdays, and then they're archived. You can listen to them on demand after that. And like I said, May 24th, it'll be 500 shows. I can't believe it myself.
Well, congratulations on the 500th show. It was so cool and odd running into you here in Chicago, and I'm glad that we've had this conversation. As you know, I was a Lucy buff as well, and I think the second podcast that I did here was with Lucy's secretary of all those years, 22 years or some such thing, Wanda Clark.
Yes, I'm still friends with Wanda today. She's retired and living in Oklahoma.
I know.
She's been on my show four or five times, and she was my confidant during all those years. She and a gentleman named Frank Gorey, who
the
was
driver.
The security guy at their house.
And the driver, right?
Yes. He was originally Desi's driver, and then after the divorce, Lucy kept him on at the house, and he was in charge of security there because she didn't have a gate, and she didn't have she had a burglar alarm, but she didn't have a gate, and people would camp on her lawn and, you know, wait for her, try to climb her walls and all that. And Frank was in charge of doing all that in a very nice way. Frank is still alive today. He's approaching 90 years old. He still drives. He still works. He's a great guy. But Frank and Wanda were my confidants. They really taught me the ropes on what to do and what not to do when working for them. And if it wasn't for their guidance, I would not have lasted working for Lucy, until she passed in 1989.
Yeah, well, great to talk to you. Perhaps we'll do it again. Congratulations on show number 500.
Yeah, I'm amazed. I can't believe it myself. Thanks. And I'll be listening to you from now on, too.
I love it. Thank you. Okay. Great to talk to you, Stu.
Same here, Steve. Thank you.